expansion, which really becomes significant in the chapters ahead, but it starts in this period we are right now in the reign of around the time of Jehu. So we'll be looking at the Assyrian Empire, just some history about that tonight, and then we've talked a little bit about what Hazael has done from Syria in cutting off Israel. We've talked about that a little bit already. Jehoiada enthrones Joash in Judah, and then Athaliah is executed, and that'll be toward the end of our study tonight. So again, glad that we can be together. Here's this period of the kings. Again, I stole Wayne's chart and threw it up there. So we're looking at Athaliah being queen, the usurper, in at the bottom there, and then Joash is going to be coronated in our lesson. That time period, by the way, it's a little deceiving on the chart because the heads are over here about 800, but really the lines go to here about 850, 840 is the time period that we're looking at for this queen and king. All right, so in looking at the Assyrian Empire, its capital is Nineveh in ancient times. Famous, comes into a number of Bible stories. We remember it especially because of Jonah's relationship to it, but it's the capital of Assyria for a good long period of time. It's a strong capital as far as that goes, and is fortified as you go along. The Assyrian Empire, as clearly seen here, is northeast of Israel. Modern Iran. Later on, the Persians would have this area, and so really I think the Iranians relate more to the Persians, but you can see, even on this map, it's just really big, and the area that we've been looking at, this whole divided kingdom, that's right here. So it's just a really small spot in the Middle Eastern world this time. What all of our emphasis has been on really just a very small area, if you think about it, compared to everything that's going on in the big wide world. And you can just see that even in this map, and this would not even expand to other things we might look at. But God is going to use Assyria. They're developing, as I've already said, during this time period into a really mighty and fierce empire that God is going to use as a tool for judgment, both on Israel and to some extent on Judah. And others as well, as far as that goes. God does this often in biblical history, and this is a sterling example of Him reigning among the nations, causing certain nations to rise up so that others may be punished or influenced in this way or that. And God is in charge of what goes on among the nations, and this is going to be a great example of that. The big rival during most of this Assyrian period is Egypt. I think Assyria would have liked to have conquered Egypt. There are major battles between the two of them as you go down for the next century and a half or so, maybe a little bit longer. But that is something that'll come into the periphery of the Bible story a couple of times. But Jehu interacted with King Shalmaneser III of Assyria. This is really the first time in the Bible we have Assyria really coming into play in much of the Bible history. So those are some of the significant things about it that we'll be touching on in the next few moments. So as we think about the Assyrian Empire, if you're going through the Bob and Sandra Waldron book, their curriculum, it sort of stops the narrative of history here and talking about the kings and what's going on in Israel and Judah to look at Assyria, and so that's what we're going to do as well. And again, Assyria has been slowly growing, and it's going to become a key actor on the world stage and in the histories of Israel and Judah, as I've already said, affecting both of them in pretty big ways. Other ancient kingdoms that we've looked at that Israel has been interacting with and to some degree will continue to interact with, like Syria and Moab and Edom and Ammon and Philistia and Phoenicia, all of these are very small kingdoms in the big wide world. And so in that map that we showed of all of Assyria, again, this is just a small part of the world, and all of those kingdoms are relatively small compared to everything else that's going on. It's important that we not confuse Syria and Assyria. I'll try to make sure to say the A before that every time. Much different places, much different people. The Syrians that Israel and Judah have already had a lot to do with over the centuries now continue that, but Assyria becomes this large power that influences all of these kingdoms. So the geographical power of Assyria had sort of ebbed and flowed, but about the time of Solomon's kingdom, when it divided, that the Assyrian kingdom began to expand and slowly will really gobble up a good bit of that part of the world. The Assyrian Empire was known for its cruelty and its harshness, as has been said and observed by a lot of historians. Number of things could be said here. I was talking with Wayne about it a minute ago, and he was talking about, you know, the Assyrians' approach to dealing with other nations that were kind of gobbling up nations, a bit like Hitler gobbled up Europe. But it was like they sent an emissary, and they say, you know, you want to pay tribute to us, and you know, let us take charge here. And if they said no, then they would send an army and surround them with the army, and they'd say, okay, how about now? And if they said no to that, then the Assyrians would wipe them out. And in wiping them out, I mean, they really wiped them out. What every kingdom that we're going to look at, every world kingdom that we're going to look at from now on, from the Assyrians to the Babylonians, on to the Medes and the Persians and the Greeks, these are the four large empires that will arise in the next few hundred years in biblical history. But one observation to make is every one of these empires dealt with its kingdoms that it conquered and the people that it conquered in a different way. Each one of them had a unique way of, what do you do with the people you've conquered? How do you deal with those people? And so the Assyrians' approach was, as we'll see when we get to them conquering the northern kingdom, the Assyrians' approach was basically you completely overwhelm the land with military force. Then you take as many people captive as you want to, and you take them to other lands that you've captured. So you just spread them out all over the place. And the purpose of that is, if you take an Israelite, for instance, and you put him over in Babylon or, you know, Greece somewhere or whatever it is, you take them, they're not going to want to fight for those lands because they're not living in their lands anymore. They're not going to rebel against you when they're living in some foreign country. You know, what they're not going to get together and band against you and form a revolt. That's never going to happen. So the Assyrians, very wisely, when they captured people, they just scattered them all over the place. What the Babylonians did was different. They would just wipe nearly everybody out that they conquered, killing most of them. But they would take the very best of those people and bring them to Babylon to use them in the Babylonian kingdom. That's why Daniel goes to Babylon with his friends, and probably Ezekiel too, as far as that goes. So again, a whole different approach. When the Persians come, they try to make friends with everybody. They say, okay, we're going to send everybody that's been taken captive, we're going to send you back home and be nice to you and let you build your shrines and your temples and all of that. And so the captives get to come home after 70 years, right? But that's how the Persians dealt with their captives. The Greeks had a whole different thing. When they came along, they began to conquer the world, and what they would say is, we're just going to make everybody Greek. We're going to teach them our language. We're going to teach them the love of our culture. We're going to show them our art, and we're just going to make everybody want to be a Greek. And they were pretty successful at that. So each one of these kingdoms had this different approach to how they deal with nations they conquered. Right now, we're in Assyria. They're going to be cruel. They're not somebody to mess with. And if you do, you're probably going to get hurt. So in the story that we're in right now in the narrative, Ahab had defeated Ben-Hadad of Syria in battle twice. So Syria and Israel are going at each other. We've seen that repeatedly. Ahab dies when he fights with Ben-Hadad that third time, when he allies himself with Jehoshaphat, or Jehoshaphat goes along with him. Ahab dies in that third battle. But a few years before Ahab's death, Shalmaneser, the Assyrian king, invades Canaan. At that time, Ahab in Israel and Ben-Hadad in Syria form an alliance to try to withstand the Assyrian onslaught. So here you have two really rival kingdoms, Syria and Israel. They join together to fight their common enemy. right? So the enemy of my enemy is my friend, that kind of thing. They join together to fight Assyria, and they're not really wholly successful. Assyria is a little bit more than they can handle. And this occurs at the Battle of Karkar in 853 BC. That's right in the middle of the time period we're looking at in Israel. So Shalmaneser defeats this coalition, but he's not able to enter into Canaan at this time and decisively take it. So we don't have it. Obviously, it doesn't happen in the biblical account. It didn't happen in history. But he's a force to be reckoned with, and that becomes clear. So Hazael, when he's king of Syria, he's anointed by Elisha. This is 842, 2 Kings 8. We've looked at that already. And he's going to do a lot of hurt in Israel himself. But around that time, just after that time, Shalmaneser attacks Syria. This was about the time that we are at in the biblical narrative. This is when Athaliah has just usurped Judah's throne. So she's just killed all of the royal descendants and taken over Judah's throne right about this time. Hazael had to face Assyria alone because Jehu in Israel, who was the king about that time, would not come to his aid this time. So now Hazael has to face Assyria alone. Shalmaneser comes all the way to Damascus, the capital city of Syria, and does everything but take it. So just puts the fear in the Syrians, but is not able to take Damascus during that period. So that's, again, we're seeing the rise of Assyria. We're seeing its inroads into the northern fringe of Israel and its bordering countries in Syria. Shalmaneser, in attacking Syria then in 841 BC, instead of, as we've already said, joining Hazael to fight Shalmaneser, what Jehu does is he submits to the Assyrian king and he pays tribute, which was frankly probably pretty smart. Jehu was very savvy politically, we've already seen that, and a pretty sharp ruler in a lot of ways. He sees there's no sense in me joining with Syria to fight against Assyria. I'll just bow the knee, and they'll be happy with that, and let us alone. And for a while, he was right. So that's what Jehu decides to do and does. Hazael is left to fight alone, as we've already said. So what Shalmaneser does then, as he makes the conquest of these periods, as many ancient kings would do, when their conquests are completed, they want a history of those. And usually they want to leave their history in stone for propaganda. You know, so they make a history of their great deeds and their conquests, and they want that history to be left in stone. And usually it's very favorable to the king who's making the monument. This is a monument that's known as the Black Obelisk of Shalmaneser III. It has various artistic depictions, reliefs on it, depicting battles that Shalmaneser won and lands that he had taken and conquests of a number of kings. There's a number of drawings on it of kings that were submitting to him. And included among those drawings is one of Jehu. There's a panel that reads, "The Tribute of Jehu, the Son of Omri." Foreign kingdoms, we already noticed this before, but foreign kingdoms saw Israel, their lineage of kings, as the House of Omri, although we know that that's not strictly correct, but that's how they referred to it. So Jehu, Son of Omri, is the way that Shalmaneser describes the king of Israel. This is a close-up of that happening. This, by the way, is in the British Museum. I had a privilege of taking that picture a few years ago. And it's the monument's about 6 feet high, made out of stone. It's really impressive just to look at, and when you consider how old it is, that's, you're looking at something that's, you know, 2,800 years old, that's telling a story. That's pretty interesting. But here is the... at the drawing, the carving, if you will, and what it's showing is this is Jehu or somebody representing Jehu down here, and this is Kalmanizer or somebody representing him. Now, did they actually look like that? I don't know if the person who did this, carving was actually saw Jehu or not, but it's kind of interesting to speculate that. This is, according to most scholars, this would be recognized as the earliest image of a single Israelite that we have from ancient times. Again, about 840-ish BC. So it gets to be Jehu, who's we've studied and is renowned. But that's an interesting picture that we have of some of the events surrounding the Bible story at this time. Do you have questions or thoughts about any of that? Anybody? I hope you find it a little bit interesting, at least, as we're going forward. It'll help you understand what Assyria is and what both Israel and Judah are dealing with when they now have to begin to deal with Assyria in the chapters to come. All right. So we're going to go now to the text of Scripture, which is where we want to be anyway, in 2 Chronicles chapter 23. Just a reminder, and maybe if you weren't in the class last time, again, what has happened is Athaliah, her son, has been slain, is no longer king of Judah. She decides she's going to be the queen. She wipes out all of the royal heirs, her grandchildren, essentially, everybody she can get her hands on except for one, and this one is saved by Jehoshabeth, the daughter of the king, the wife of the priest, Jehoiada. And Jehoiada is going to, Jehoshabeth are going to preserve Joash and keep him safe from Athaliah's murderous campaign until he can be crowned queen. And that's what we're going to be seeing. He can be crowned king. And that's what we're going to be seeing in the next few minutes. So let's pick up the story in 2 Chronicles. The time had really come to bring Judah's rightful king out of hiding. Again, Jehoiada had been hiding Joash for several years in the area of the temple, preparing for this moment, knowing that Athaliah could not sit on the throne of Judah. It was not God's will. It was not right. She was not good for Judah. She was an evil person in every way, as we've seen, and she needed to be taken out, and he was the person to do it. I think God using him for that purpose. So the text begins in 2 Chronicles chapter 23 and verse 1. In the seventh year, that's the seventh year of Athaliah's reign, seventh year of hiding Joash. In the seventh year, Jehoiada strengthened himself and made a covenant with the captains of hundreds, Azariah, the son of Jehoram, Ishmael, the son of Jehonadab, Azariah, the son of Obed, Maaseiah, the son of Adiah, and Elishaphat, the son of Zichri. So he's made a covenant, an agreement, gotten the ear of, and got the allegiance of some of the key military leaders in Israel, and they're named here. And then they went throughout the land, in verse 2. They went throughout Judah and gathered the Levites from all the cities of Judah, the chief fathers of Israel, and they came to Jerusalem. A couple of things to notice here. Jehoiada is strengthening himself. He knows what he needs to do. He needs to get the rightful king anointed as king and accepted by the people, enthroned. He needs to do that. He needs to have a good military backing from the people, and especially a backing of the religious and spiritual leaders, of which he was the chief since he was the high priest. So he needs all of that in order for this to work. He doesn't go off just with I got a good idea and I'm just going to go off and do this. But there's a lot of planning, thought, no doubt prayer, wisdom of God you see at work here. And so he's going to arrange everything with a lot of forethought to bring Joash to the throne. He strengthens himself, and I don't think it doesn't mean he's lifting weights, right? He strengthens himself politically with his alliances with both the Levites and the military force. So he's strengthening himself, making sure everybody's together here, and apparently a large part of the people as well, who were probably sick and tired of Athaliah, if they had anything to him at all. So that's what's happening. We come then to see what exactly that Jehoiada accomplishes. First of all, he establishes an armed protective detail around Joash, who needs just a child still, 7 years old or so, needs to be protected. He gathers the nation's leadership to solicit their support. You see that in verse 2 that I just read. And then everybody is committed. He gets everybody on board to what God has spoken, to what we're trying to accomplish here. Chapter 23 and verse 3 of 2 Chronicles. And all the assembly made a covenant with the king in the house of God. All the assembly, that's all of the people, all of these military, all the Levites, all of them. And he said to them, "Behold, the king's son shall reign as the Lord has said of the sons of David." Now that goes all the way back to the promise that God made to David in 2 Samuel 7. When our prayers and our actions and our purposes align with the promises of God, we are on super good footing. God will advance our cause. And Jehoiada is advancing this to the people, and they're agreeing that they're going to do what God has ordained in getting a son of David on the throne, as was promised by God to David. Of course, that, again, that goes back to 2 Samuel 7. So he in verses 4 and 5, he instructs the people and his forces as to how they're to deal with all of this. He divides the guards into companies to keep watch. Verse 4, this is what you shall do. One-third of you entering on the Sabbath of the priests and the Levites shall be keeping watch over the doors. One-third shall be at the king's house, and one-third at the gate at the foundation. All the people shall be in the courts of the house of the Lord. So everybody's got their place to be, divided up to protect the temple, to protect Joash, the child king, to be. And then in verse 6, he says, "Let no one come into the house of the Lord except the priests and those of the Levites who serve. They may go in, for they are holy, but all the people shall keep the watch of the Lord." So there's a distinguishing between the holy people who could actually go into the temple and those who must stay in the courts. It's interesting to me, Jehoiada is the high priest. Of course, he'd be really well aware of all of this. Some of the people may not be because of all that had been going on, probably pollution of the temple and everything else during some of this time period. In any case, Jehoiada's clear. We're not going to profane the temple. We're not going to profane the temple. We're not going to do war in the temple. Okay? We're going to keep the temple holy. The people who are in it are going to be holy. Everybody else who's involved in this is going to be outside the confines of the temple. And this goes back, of course, way back to when God instituted the tabernacle on which the temple was sort of patterned, that the children of Israel shouldn't come into it. Were to stay outside. And it was only the Levites and the priests that were to go into the inner courts. So Jehoiada is respecting the law of God and the will of God in all of this, really immensely so. What goes next is he surrounds young Joash with a good bit of protection. Let's read this in verse 7. "The Levites shall surround the king on all sides." The king, that is the king to come, the 7-year-old, Joash. "Surround him on all sides, every man with his weapons in his hand. Whoever comes into the house, let him be put to death. You are to be with the king when he comes in and when he goes out." So protection detail for the king at all times. "So the Levites and all Judah did according to all that Jehoiada the priest had commanded. And each man took his men who were to be on duty on the Sabbath with those who were going off duty on the Sabbath. For Jehoiada the priest had not dismissed the divisions." And so everybody's all hands on deck is what that's saying. And Jehoiada the priest gave to the captains of hundreds the spears and the large and small shields which had belonged to King David that were in the temple of God. Now, there is poetic justice. There is, you know, the way things ought to be. here these men are defending the heir of David, the heir to the throne, with the weapons that David left here, the spears and the shields. These are the weapons that these men are carrying, the very weapons of David. And so this is just a sort of a beautiful, wonderfully timed, in the providence of God, event that is occurring as Jehoiada, no doubt following what he believed to be, and I think certainly was, the will of God during this time period. We come down then to verse 11. They brought out the king's son, and they put the crown on him. And they gave him the testimony and made him king. Then Jehoiada and his sons anointed him and said, "Long live the king." So the king is crowned. The king is given the testimony. And if I understand the reference there, and I believe we can understand it from Scripture, if you look way back in Exodus, the commandments that were, Ten Commandments that were put in the ark are called the testimony. So the testimony there is the law of God written. The testimony, the law of Moses. Exodus 25:16 is a reference there. And that law was, according to what Moses told the people in Deuteronomy, when they had a king over there. Remember Deuteronomy chapter 17 and later on even, there Moses, in talking to the children of Israel, before they enter the land, he tells them, "You're going to have a king." Well, they weren't even a nation really yet. They didn't have a territory yet. But he says, "You're going to have a king. And when you have a king, you're supposed to give him the law, and he's supposed to keep the law with him, and he's supposed to read it." So receiving the law of God was symbolic of being the king. That's what the king was supposed to do. He was supposed to be given by the priests the law of God to keep with him and read. So being given the testimony here is at least a really symbolic act, and may have been something that was supposed to have been done with every coronation. I'm not sure. But it seems like Moses is saying something like that when in Deuteronomy 17, he says this in verse 18 of Deuteronomy 17. "It shall be," talking about the king, "it shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests and the Levites." So he's supposed to have a copy of the law, "and it shall be with him. He shall read it all the days of his life that he may learn to fear the Lord his God and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes." Now that was not done for probably most of the kings, but here it appears that it's being done, that the law is given to the king, which again, impressive on Jehoiada's part for sure, the way he's approaching this. And they shout out, as they do in all of the movies, you know, all the movies when anybody's crowned king, "Long live the king," right? I think they did that when King Charles was crowned not long ago in England. "Long live the king." Athaliah, the evil queen, hears all of this going on. And in verse 12, "When Athaliah heard the noise of the people running and praising the king, she came to the people in the temple of the Lord. She looked, and there was the king standing by his pillar at the entrance, and the leaders and the trumpeters were by the king, and all the people of the land were rejoicing and blowing trumpets, also the singers with musical instruments, and those who led in praise. So Athaliah tore her clothes," no doubt in grief and rage, "and shouts, 'Treason, treason.'" Now that's what you call ironic. I mean, here, the most treasonous person, or one of them, probably in the whole history of Israel, murdering her own grandchildren to get the throne, shouting treason when they're crowning the proper and rightful king. But that's the way she looked at the world. You know, some people have a weird way of looking at the world, don't they? And it seems to revolve all around them. We seem to have a lot of those in the world today. Just the world revolves around me, and here's how I look at it. But that was Athaliah for sure. And her perception of this is just, that in itself is breathtaking. But Jehoiada orders her execution. In verse 14, Jehoiada the priest brought out the captains of hundreds who were set over the army. These are the ones he'd made alliances with already, and so he's prepared for all of this. "Take her outside under guard, slay her with the sword, whoever follows her with the sword, whoever follows her, so not only her, but also her immediate followers. For the priest had said, do not kill her in the house of the Lord. There was not going to be bloodshed in God's house. So they seized her. She went by the way of the entrance of to the horse gate. This would be where the horses came in and out of this area, into the king's house, and they killed her there. So just exactly according to the plan of Jehoiada in removing her and setting up Joash as king. I want to think for just a few minutes about at least one, there might be several, overall lessons that we can learn from this pretty fascinating account, in my mind. This instance of Jehoiada anointing Joash and elevating him to the throne, as we've hinted at already, it really required a lot of wisdom and courage on Jehoiada's part. It's one thing to be courageous and want to do God's will and be courageous in attempting that. It's something else to have wisdom and understand how to go about accomplishing things. Wisdom and courage don't always meet in people. We sometimes have courageous people who don't have a lot of wisdom, and sometimes we have wise people who don't have a lot of courage. We need people with courage and wisdom. And you really see that in Jehoiada on I think, full display. The Lord says to us through Paul in 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 13 that we are to watch, we are to stand fast in the faith, be brave, be strong. And the Old King James Version says, quit ye like men, you know, stand like men and fight. We need people of courage in the Lord's church. But we have to have the moral and spiritual resolve coupled with, you know, wisdom is understanding the risks that are involved and what the risks are and what we can do to either eliminate or reduce risk going forward. You don't have to, Paul, you know, the Apostle Paul never threw himself in the fire, right? He never said, yeah, just go ahead and take me to the lions. He resisted that. There was a lot of wisdom in the way Paul dealt with. He's a very courageous person, proclaiming God's word, doing God's work, but a lot of wisdom in the way he went forward in dealing with all of that. And so it is with us. We have to have this moral and spiritual resolve, but also an understanding of the risks that are involved and a wise plan of action and ultimately complete trust in God. There are a couple of examples that just jump out at me, and I think others who've taught this, particularly Esther. I thought of her immediately. Here she is. We go back, or forward, I guess it would be, to the book of Esther. Her people are about to be slaughtered by the evil plots of Haman. You remember the story? She's made aware by Mordecai, her kinsman, as to what's about to happen. It's a horrible time for Jews in the land of captivity. And I want to go back, or forward again, I should say, and look at these verses in Esther, which I think are pretty familiar to us. Esther chapter 4. Mordecai is trying to encourage her to do what she needs to do to appeal to the king on behalf of the people and get this murderous plot stopped. And he tells her in chapter 4 and verse 13 through messengers, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all of the Jews. If you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews, but from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this? So, you know, Esther didn't plan to be put in the middle of all of this danger and try to be the one to solve this huge problem. But her response in verse 16 is, go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan, fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. But she has a plan going forward as she goes into the king. She's received by him. She has a plan going forward to how to expose Haman, and she does that very wisely, just not all at once, but by a series of banquets, as you remember, and all of that. So here's a woman with extreme courage, not just rushing headlong into something, but the thing that she does most of all, although God's name is not mentioned in the book of Esther, what's plain is the thing she does most of all is trust God. The fasting, and all of that that goes on before even she makes this attempt, she trusts God. So all of that comes together in her story. I think it comes together pretty well in Jehoiada's story. And if you go forward in the book of Acts, Peter and John, same sort of thing. The wisdom, the courage, the thoughtfulness that they went forward. They're not just recklessly risking their lives. God doesn't ask us to recklessly risk our lives. Our lives are at risk all of the time. But we need to use wisdom to do his work, to get it done in the best way possible, without harm, if possible. At least without harm to good people, if possible. So all of that takes a lot of forethought. I mean, I need to stop there. Anybody else have a thought or question, comment? Anybody at all?
Why do you think, in God's providence, they brought out Joash at this point in time of life, at that age? Any idea?
I'm not sure. That's an interesting age. We have a couple of others that are brought out 7, 8 years old. For us, that's still just a child, not capable of doing a whole lot. They can communicate, and you can communicate to them very well at that age.
People who read the Testament probably will get
into it. Yeah, you're usually, all human beings tend to be pretty good readers by that time if they're taught. We can read by then. That's a good point too, yeah. Anything else, Wayne? Oh, yeah. So Wayne is mentioning, you know, Jehoiada, I think there's no doubt he knew God's promise to David all along. And even when Athaliah starts her killing spree, Jehoshaphat recognizes, and Jehoiada, I think both must recognize, an heir to the throne has got to be saved of the line of David. And that's the time, as Wayne's saying, you got to step up and do what needs doing. And in rescuing Joash at that time was critical. And of course, they did that. All right, we need to stop. Appreciate y'all's good attention tonight. Thank you.